I've divided the ear itself into the outer, the middle, and the inner ear. The outer part, of course, starts with the pinna, the part we see, and then there's a canal that goes in a few inches, and it's terminated by the eardrum. And when sound waves are incident on the pinna, that sets up pressure vibrations in this ear canal, and the size and shape of that canal has a great deal of effect on the way we hear things, as we'll see after a bit. Well, so the eardrum is set into vibration by alternating pressure, sound pressures that are incident on it. And it in turn is coupled to three small bones, which are called the ossicles, the hammer, anvil, stirrup, if you remember your ninth grade general science. And these bones transmit the pressure vibrations and actually act as levers. I won't go into the mechanical advantage that you get from those, but they change a fairly low pressure, large movement of the eardrum into a much higher pressure and smaller amount of movement at the entrance to the inner ear, which is the third part, probably the most complex part of the auditory organ. The inner ear is mainly composed of the cochlea, and the cochlea has, leading from it, the auditory nerve, which transmits the messages to the brain, to the processing system. It also has attached to it three semicircular canals. Now, those have little or no function in hearing, but they're the things that allow us to keep our balance. So, nature built in a few little auxiliary items into the ear, as well as to hear. It serves as a center of balance. All right, the cochlea then looks sort of like a snail. It's all coiled up, and in order to see how it works, we think of it as, view it as being uncoiled, or first we might look at the cross-sectional area of it. In cross-section, the cochlea is divided into two chambers, the scala vestibuli and the scala tympani. And these two chambers are separated by a pair of membranes, the Reisner's membrane and the basilar membrane. And both of them are filled with fluid. And at the entrance to the upper chamber is the oval window and the stapes, the stirrup, like bone, presses against the oval window. And so as the eardrum moves and causes these bones to move, you get pressure on the upper chamber via the oval window. Now, if we unrolled the cochlea, we'd see that down the center of it are these two membranes. We look at only one of them. Yeah. Sure. We look at only one of them, the basilar membrane, which is supported along two sides by a bony shelf. And the basilar membrane then moves up and down in accordance with pressure variations that are transmitted through the fluid. And if we looked at the basilar membrane, we'd see that pressure fluctuations cause the basilar membrane to wave up and down. Now, you notice that the basilar membrane is thicker and narrower at the oval window end, and it's thinner and broader at the opposite end, so that pressure fluctuations of different frequencies excite different parts of the basilar membrane preferentially. Pressure fluctuations of low frequency tend to have most effect at the far end of the basilar membrane. Pressure fluctuations of high frequency tend to have most effect at the near end. And so the basilar membrane itself is sort of a crude frequency analyzer. But our ability to distinguish between pitches of two musical tones, or to distinguish between two vowel sounds, what we do when we tell an ah from an ih or something like that, we're really looking at small fluctuations in pitch. And so in order to hear the sounds of music, or in order to comprehend speech sounds, the auditory system has to be an extremely sensitive frequency analyzer, and the mechanical effect of frequency analysis done on the basilar membrane is far too crude to do the job, so that there's a higher order pitch processor as well, as we'll see in a moment. All right, now we've got two ears, right? In fact, we're given one mouth and two ears, so I guess Mother Nature expected us to listen twice as much as we talk, right? There are a number of advantages in having two ears, other than just redundancy. If you lose hearing in one, you still got the other to fall back on. You depend upon binaural or two-ear hearing for localization of sounds. That's one of the things that you, one of the benefits you derive from two ears. And the localization of a sound is something that you do with a great deal of accuracy. You can do it very precisely. You rely on clues from several different sources. At high frequencies, the head sort of casts a shadow. And if a sound source is directly ahead of you, then you get approximately the same intensity of sound at both ears. But if the sound source is off to one side or the other, then the intensity is slightly greater at the inboard ear than the outboard ear, because the head itself casts a shadow. And the auditory processor takes this into account. And if one ear gets a slightly more intense signal than the other, then it says, aha, the sound is coming from over there somewhere. But the amazing thing is how accurately you can determine the source of a sound by using these clues. Well, at lower frequencies, it turns out that the head doesn't cast a very good shadow. In order to get a sharp shadow of light or sound or any kind of wave disturbance, the obstacle has to be at least as large as a wavelength, and preferably a couple of times larger than a wavelength. And so for sounds of low frequency, the head is, they go right around. They diffract around the head as if it weren't there. You can tell that sound is pretty efficiently diffracted just by the fact that you can hear through an open door. If somebody is, if a door is left open and you're not in a direct line of sight, you don't see the person, but you hear them. And this is, of course, because the obstacle is not large compared with a wavelength, or the opening in this case. So at low frequencies, the diffraction defeats the clues that you get by differential intensity, and then the auditory system goes to a another scheme for clues. It measures the arrival time of the sound at the two ears. And even if the sound source is many feet away, why, there's a few inches of difference in the distance to one ear as opposed to the other. And so the two sounds are going to arrive slightly at slightly different times, or if they're continuous sounds, in slightly different phase. And the auditory sensor is able to distinguish between these two sounds. Now, I have a favorite demonstration that I do, and I didn't succeed in getting a piece of hose to do it for you, but I'll have to tell you about it. And that is, if you take a tube, a long tube, and put one end in each ear, and then close your eyes and have somebody tap along that tube, the distance to one ear, if you're right in the middle of that length of tube, why, it sounds like the tapping is right straight ahead of you. But if the tapping is moved only a 2 or 3 inches down the tube, so that to one ear the tube length is, say, 5 feet, 9 inches, and the other one it's 6 feet, just a very small difference in the distance, right away it sounds like the sound has moved over to the left or to the right. When I do the demonstration class, I usually have somebody sit there with a tube, and then he's supposed to point where he hears the sound. And the class can see that you just move the tapping point a very, very small amount, and he changes from this to this. So the ear's ability to localize by means of these multiple clues is very, very uncanny. In fact, there is a third clue that comes into use at fairly high frequencies, and that is the directionality of the pinna itself. The fact that at quite high frequencies, where wavelengths are small compared with the external part of the pinna, you can actually do some localization by turning your head and listening to the change in intensity of sound. Now, many animals have ears that are specially designed for that. If you watch a dog, when he hears a sound, he perks up his ears and he actually turns them a little bit. We don't have that ability to turn our pin around, but we do turn our head and we can localize sound. So the computer takes all these clues and puts them together and says, aha, the sound is over there, and it's amazing how close we can come. Well, as far as perceiving music and speech and things, there are a number of different physical quantities that we measure in the auditory system, and on the basis of these physical quantities, we determine certain subjective qualities of the sound. So I've made a kind of a matrix that's really going to summarize the whole talk, and that is, I've listed the physical parameters that you can measure along the left-hand column. The sound pressure, that measures how much energy the sound wave carries. A microphone is really a pressure sensor, and a sound level meter, various instruments, respond to the amount of sound pressure. The frequency, of course, I think you're all familiar with, is the number of vibrations per second. Middle C has 261 vibrations per second. You raise the, go up to the next C on the piano keyboard, you've doubled the number of vibrations per second. The spectrum means the recipe for the sound, the intensity, the strength of each of the partial components in the sound, and we'll talk more about that a little later. The duration means the actual time the sound lasts, and the envelope means the way in which the sound comes on, the onset of the sound, and the decay of the sound. A plucked sound is has quite a different envelope from a the sound of, say, a blown instrument or the sound of a voice, which comes on relatively slowly. All right, now on the basis of these physical parameters, which you can actually measure, your auditory system measures them, but you can measure them with instruments in the laboratory quite nicely also, are these subjective qualities, loudness, pitch, timbre, duration? Well, loudness depends mainly on the sound pressure, but not entirely, because you can have two sounds, one at a very low frequency and one at a frequency around 1,000 hertz where the ears are quite sensitive, and if even though the sound pressure is exactly the same, the 1,000 hertz tone will sound many times louder than, say, the 50 hertz tone. The ears are much less sensitive to low frequencies. So that frequency does plays a role in loudness. The spectrum plays a role in loudness. You can listen to a pure tone, a sine wave, at a certain sound pressure level, and then you can listen to a tone that has a lot of harmonics at the same sound pressure level, and the one with the harmonics will sound a good deal louder. So spectrum plays a role. Duration plays a role. A very short pulse of sound does not sound as loud as one of the same sound pressure that lasts a little longer. So where you see three pluses, that means it depends a great deal. Where you see one plus, it means it depends to a slight amount. But everything seems to depend upon everything else, right? The pitch, for instance, depends mainly on the frequency. But it does depend to a small extent on loudness. We were trying out on the organ this afternoon to see if we could demonstrate this, but the you can get a, is it on? You can get a very small effect, but the organ on the pure stops, on the flute stops, which is what we'd want to use, doesn't have more than about a 10 dB dynamic range. It just doesn't, there isn't much adjustment for expression. It's kind of frustrating to me to give this talk 1,500 miles away from my lab, you see, because I'm so used to bringing all this equipment into the lecture hall and setting it up and putting on a show or demonstrating all these things that you have to accept on faith. Sorry about that. When you come to my lab, I'll demonstrate them all for you. Okay, so that's what really we're going to talk about, some of these interactions. We won't have time to talk about all of them by any means. All right, let me first show you a graph, and you're sure going to get tired of looking at graphs since I can't do demonstrations with equipment. One of the best ways to describe the results that you get when you make these measurements is by drawing a graph. All right, this first one shows the subjective loudness. It's measured in a unit called zones. Don't worry too much about zones. I don't really have time to describe in great detail how you derive a scale of zones. But just think of it, a zone is a way of measuring the subjective loudness. A sound that's at 50 sones will sound louder than one that's at 40 sones. What I want to show is the frequency dependence of the loudness. Now, both the blue and the green lines are curves of constant sound pressure. In other words, look at the top ones here. These are sounds that have a sound pressure level, we call it, of 90 decibels. The blue one is a pure tone, one frequency. The green one is a more musical, believable tone, one with exactly five harmonics of about equal strength. Notice, in the case of the pure tone, the ear has very prominent resonances, one around 3,000 hertz, and one at, between 3,000 and 4,000, and one between 10 and 11,000 hertz. Now, these are actually due to resonances of the outer ear. If you blow across a closed pipe, it hums at a given pitch. And if you blow harder, you can get it to jump to the third harmonic of that, to an octave plus a fifth. Those are the first two modes of the resonances of a closed pipe. Well, you see, the ear canal is acting sort of like a closed organ pipe, with the eardrum closing off one end of it, and this being the open side. So it has very prominent resonances between 3,000 and 4,000 hertz, depending upon how your head's constructed, and then at three times that. Pete? Yeah. The second resonance should be at three times the first. Now, these, of course, are average curves. When you construct a set of curves like this, this is for the average person. Somebody may have a big head, and that moves it down to a lower frequency, or a short ear canal moves it to a higher frequency. But you see, when you talk about a musically realistic tone with harmonics, then the resonances aren't quite as prominent. You still get a bulge in the center. It's very clear that a tone with a sound pressure level of 80 decibels certainly is going to sound a lot louder if the fundamental is around 1,000 hertz than if the fundamental is down here around 100 hertz. Well, that's why you have to make tubas bigger than flutes, huh? That's one reason. There are others. All right, while we're talking about the dependence on frequency, let's just kind of define the auditory domain. The blue curve here, am I getting that off the bottom of the screen? The blue curve defines an average limit of hearing. You notice that the threshold of audibility is at its lowest point around 3 to 4,000 hertz, where that resonance of the outer ear is. And then as you go down in frequency, you have to raise the sound pressure level, vertical axis, in order to get a sound inside the blue box. And music, of course, comes in all sizes and shapes, but a rough limit on the sound level of music and the frequency limits of music is given by this red curve. You might get some rock music going off the end here and so on, but kind of a rough estimate of what range of dynamics of sound pressure level and what range of frequencies is included in musical perception is defined by this. So if you have a hearing loss that cuts off this part of it, you lose, you have an idea of what you lose in music. Now, if I drew the speech bands on here, the fundamental frequencies in most vowel sounds run from about 1,000 up to 2,000 hertz. But you consider usually the speech band as being maybe 500 hertz up to about 3,000. About this much. You don't make that much use of a very high frequencies. About the only time you ever get anything up at the very high end is when you say an S, which I guess up in Minnesota the Scandinavians put a lot of energy into their S's. You very rarely have much content in speech below 500 hertz. Of course, the fundamental pitch may be as low as 150 hertz if a person has a deep voice. that's a whole other talk in itself, hearing loss. It's a very interesting subject. How you lose hearing with old age, how you lose hearing with life in our noisy environment, and so on and so forth. All right. Now, the idea of a critical bandwidth in the basilar membrane is a very important one because it explains so many things for us. And there are several ways to describe the critical bandwidth, but I think perhaps the easiest one is to look at this graph and say that supposing we have a sound with a number of partials that has some harmonic content at a sound pressure level of 60 decibels and a center frequency of 1,000 hertz. Well, now, if we confine the partials to a pretty narrow band around 1,000 hertz, you get a certain degree of loudness. As you broaden out the spectrum of partials, or perhaps the best way to do the experiment would be to use noise, broadband noise. And you broaden the bandwidth of the noise, but you then as you add more partials, you decrease each of them so the total sound pressure level still stays at 60 decibels. But as you add more partials, you note that the loudness, the subjective loudness, starts to increase. Or if you start from the other end, perhaps it's more, it's easier to understand. If you start with a very broad band of noise and you gradually decrease the bandwidth, you see that the sound level goes down until you reach a certain bandwidth, in this case about 160 hertz. And when the bandwidth gets to 160 hertz, then narrowing it any further has no effect on the subjective loudness. And that is one way of defining the critical bandwidth, as that bandwidth beyond which a further reduction in the frequency bandwidth has no effect on, little or no effect on loudness. Now, physically, the way the one interpretation of the critical bandwidth is that's approximately the range of the basilar membrane that's excited. Remember we said that when sound reaches the inner ear, sets up pressure waves in the fluid in the scala vestibuli, it causes the basilar membrane to flex. And the basilar membrane has hair cells on it which are connected to neurons in the auditory nerve and fire and cause the sensations that go up to our brain and say sound. And so the extent of the basilar membrane that's excited by a sound of one frequency is one critical bandwidth. So you see, when you get down to a critical bandwidth, then it doesn't make that much difference because you're already getting messages only from one portion of the basilar membrane. And so then if you make the sound narrower or wider, it doesn't have any effect on the loudness. Well, now, how large is that critical bandwidth? Well, the critical bandwidth varies with the center frequency. At low frequencies, the critical bandwidth stays about 90 to 100 hertz. But then as the frequency goes up, the critical bandwidth increases. And at high frequencies, it is approximately a third octave wide. The blue curve here is the critical bandwidth plotted on the vertical axis as a function of the frequency on the horizontal axis. And you see at low frequencies, it's fairly constant at around 190 hertz. And then as the frequency goes up, it starts to increase approximately in proportion to the center frequency. On this curve, I've drawn two green lines. The upper green line is a one-third octave. One-third of an octave. I think you all know what an octave is, a doubling of frequency from da-da, from C to C. And so you divide that into three pieces, and that's a unit that's very often used in acoustical measurements. And this is a musical whole tone, da da, and so there's 12 of those to there. I'm sorry, there's well, there's 12 semitones. There's six of those whole tones to the octave. And so the critical bandwidth through most of the musical part of the frequency range stays between a whole tone and one-third octave. All right, here I've sketched now typical region of excitation on the basilar membrane by sounds of varying frequency. And this was really drawn to point out the effect of masking, but I think I won't have time to dwell on that very much, but let me mention it since I've drawn it. If you hear two tones simultaneously, if they're widely separated, if you hear a flute and a tuba play at the same time, there's no problem telling that it's a flute and a tuba. They don't interact particularly. But now as you hear tones that are closer and closer in frequency to one another, when they get close enough in frequency, they begin to interfere. And in particular, the lower one masks out the higher one much more than vice versa. Again, when I do the demonstration, I'll use two pure tone generators. Set one, say, at 400 hertz, and the other one at 1,000 hertz, let's say. And as I turn up the level of the 400 hertz generator, it masks out the 1,000 hertz tone. You don't even hear the 1,000 hertz tone as existing. But now, when you turn up the 1,000 hertz tone, it is unable to mask the 400 hertz. Oh, eventually it can, but it has to be a tremendous amount more intense in order to mask out the 400 hertz tone. So an instrument playing a low pitch, a trombone, can mask out a flute much better than the other way around. And the reason for that is because the region of the basilar membrane that's excited by a sound is not a symmetrical thing. It has a long tail toward the low frequency end. So supposing that A and B or toward the high frequency end, rather. So supposing that A and B represent the excitation of the basilar membrane by two different sounds, a high frequency one and a low frequency one. All right, as long as they're widely separated, there's a little interaction, but they don't mask each other. But now consider what happens if sound B gets very large. It can easily mask sound A. This is the low frequency one masking the high frequency one. But you can make A quite large, and because it doesn't extend very much out into the low frequency end, you can make A much larger than B, and it still doesn't mask out B, the sound of higher frequency. Well, there's a lot of interesting experiments with masking. We're going at kind of a breakneck pace. Let me point out that much of what I'm discussing now is going to be in a book that I've written that's going to be published. It'll be out sometime this fall. I'm here trying to sell books, I guess. But I did duplicate several of the chapters in this book, about a dozen of them, roughly a half the book. And it's available over in the bookstore. So that if you find the subject interesting and say, oh my gosh, he's going too fast, I can't follow him, why, you'll find most of what I'm saying will be in these notes over in the bookstore. It's called The Acoustics of Music and Speech, I guess. The title of the whole book will be The Science of Sound, but that will include other things as well. All right, let me describe a couple of interesting experiments having to do with the perception of pitch. There, you often, many theories of pitch are based around the place theory. That is, the pitch discrimination is largely by detecting the point on the basilar membrane where the excitation is the greatest. Well, as I said earlier, place theories of pitch and hearing fail to explain the very high degree of discrimination that we have. Now, there's kind of an alternative approach to it, where you talk not about place hearing, but you talk about periodicity hearing. and say that the ear acts as if it were a as if it were an analyzer looking for any pattern that's repeated in time. You see, if you've got a pure tone, why, there's no difference, because frequency and period are just the reciprocal each other. The one is related exactly to the other one. But now when you get to complex tones, it does make a difference. Now, one very interesting experiment that you've done many times yourself is listening to music on a small portable radio or a small portable phonograph with a very small loudspeaker. Let's say a 4 or 6 inch loudspeeker, like you have in a car radio or a little transistor portable. Well, if you stop to think of it, the wavelength of even notes an octave or so below middle C are several feet long. And a loudspeaker of that size is very, very inefficient in radiating sounds of very low frequency. Yet when you hear a piece of music on a small speaker, it sounds a little tinny, to be sure, that the timbre or the quality of the sound has changed. But you hear the bass, you hear the fundamental pitch, even though if you look, analyze the sound with instruments, you'd find very little sound content at such low frequencies. Well, what's happening really is the ear is reconstructing that missing bass. It's sometimes called the reconstruction of the missing fundamental. If you hear a bunch of harmonics with the fundamental missing, your ear will reconstruct that fundamental pitch. If any of you heard the talk I gave the other day on bells, we mentioned how the strike note of, say, an orchestral chime is a subjective pitch that's generated in your ear. If you take another way of doing the same experiment is to record the sound of a musical instrument, let's say a trombone playing A 110 hertz. All right, it's the 110 hertz is the fundamental. There are harmonics at 220 hertz, 330, 440, 550, 660, and all integral multiples of 110 hertz. And you put those all together and your ear says trombone. All right, now supposing that you record that and then selectively remove the lower harmonics by means of an electronic filter of some kind. You cut out the 110 hertz, still sounds, you still hear that same pitch. The quality has changed a little bit. You cut out the first two, you cut out both 110 and 220, and you still hear that fundamental. You can cut out 3-4 harmonics and just keep one or two of the upper harmonics, and the ear still reconstructs the lower harmonics. Well, if you read older textbooks now on physics or on acoustics, the explanation that's quite frequently given is that the ear is creating a difference tone. And so if the ear had a nonlinear behavior, like an amplifier that's overdriven, it would create a distortion product at 110 hertz. Well, that's a pretty good explanation, but it doesn't seem to tell the story right, or at least it doesn't tell the story enough. And so supposing you do the experiment in a different way, and instead of filtering out harmonics, you build up a tone with harmonics of a fundamental. Now, one way to do that, if any of you are acquainted with amplitude modulation and frequency modulation in radio, you recall that if you amplitude modulate a high frequency wave, that is, change its amplitude periodically, you introduce into the frequency spectrum some indifference frequencies. That's quite a mouthful. Let's say we have a 1200 hertz tone. We have a wave that's oscillating 1200 times per second. All right, we somehow or other, we won't worry about the details of how we do it. It's easy to do electronically. The radio stations are doing it all the time. Supposing we make that amplitude grow larger and smaller, 200 times a second, then we've amplitude modulated it at 200 hertz. All right, what we've in essence done, if we looked at that amplitude modulated wave, which I've rather crudely sketched up here, on a frequency analyzer, we'd see that we have the original 1200 hertz tone, but we also have one at 1000 and one at 1400. Those are called sidebands. All right, now we listen to this tone, and we hear 200 hertz. We hear a 200 hertz component. All right, that's easily explainable on the basis of this distortion product, the difference frequency tone. But now, supposing we keep the modulating frequency at 200 hertz, but we raise the frequency of the carrier wave, the high frequency wave. Let's say we raise it to 1240. We up it by 40 hertz. Well, the sidebands now also shift 40 hertz, right? And so the difference between the center frequency and the sidebands is still 200 hertz. But when we listen to this tone now, we find that the pitch has shifted upward a slight amount. So that it can't be explained on the basis of distortion products, difference tones. Well, there is another explanation for it, and that's on the basis of periodicity here. Because the period of the, even though the frequencies have all shifted together, the period has now changed. And I won't go into the mathematics of why this is so, but this is one experiment that points toward periodicity pitch. And if you took all the experiments that have been done on hearing, on frequency pitch perception in hearing, you'd find that some of them are more easily explained on the basis of one model, and some are more easily explained on the basis of the other. Well, which is correct? Well, apparently some aspects of each model is correct. Physicists are used to this. We have this dualism all the time. We talk about the wave theory of particles, the particle and wave theory of light, and this dualism. We call it complementarity. And the same sort of thing happens here in explaining the pitch perception in the auditory system. Depending upon how you do the experiment, it points a little bit more toward frequency analysis in the basilar membrane or frequent periodicity processing in the brain. And like so many other things in hearing, we depend upon multiple clues. And if multiple clues all point toward the same answer, then we get a very firm perception of pitch. If we have to rely on only one clue, then the pitch of a sound is somewhat weaker. It's just like what we said earlier about localization. If you can get clues from a couple of different sources, then and they all agree, then you get a fairly strong sense of pitch. All right. The just noticeable difference now in pitch, that is the smallest difference in frequency between two tones, when you can just tell that they're different, is exceedingly small. It's much less than a critical bandwidth. And you see, that in itself points to the inadequacy of the place theory of hearing. In fact, on this graph, I've shown both the critical band and the just noticeable difference, the JND, or the difference limit, as psychologists usually refer to it. And the just noticeable difference in frequency is roughly a constant percentage of the critical bandwidth, but it stays a good deal smaller. It's something like 25 times smaller than the critical bandwidth, 25 to 30 times smaller. So the same thing, the same mechanism apparently accounts for both of them, but the ability to discriminate between pitches is much greater than can be accounted for by the mechanics of excitation on the basilar membrane alone. Well, the lower graph is kind of a controversial one. Dependence of pitch on sound pressure. In general, you'll find that the crossover point is going to be around 1,000 or 2,000 hertz, and that for pure tones, tones of a single frequency, below that frequency, as the intensity, the sound pressure increases, they tend to go down in pitch, they tend to go flat. As for notes, pure tones of higher frequency, they tend to go up in pitch as the sound pressure increases. Our attempts to demonstrate this with the organ this afternoon weren't very convincing. If you know what you're trying to listen for, you can almost hear it, but I won't try to do the demonstration because I don't think I'd convince you. Okay, so let's get off pitch and get to something else. Let's get to timbre. Now, timbre is kind of an interesting quantity. In fact, there's one acoustical standards book that defines timbre as that quality by which you can distinguish two sounds that are identical in pitch and loudness. In other words, it's everything else but pitch and loudness. You can hear a sound of a trombone and the sound of a violin at exactly the same sound pressure level and exactly the same frequency, and yet there's no mistaking one for the other, is there, or is there? In fact, you can play around with pitches and I think it's a trumpet and an oboe that really, in the steady state, sound a tremendous amount alike. If you recorded an oboe playing octave C and a trumpet playing octave C, and then cut the tape so you only had a segment of the tape, you couldn't hear the attack or the release, and you played those, it's very, very difficult to tell which is which. The steady state recipe of them is the same, but the attack and release, of course, are entirely different, so that when you hear them played, you don't tend to confuse them. Well, Fourier, I've attributed it to Fourier. Fourier is certainly the person that gave spectral analysis its mathematical basis. Fourier said that any periodic vibration can be built up from a series of simple vibrations whose frequencies are harmonics of a fundamental. Harmonics, you remember, means integral multiples of like our trombone tone of 110 hertz had harmonics at 220, 330, 440, and so on. And so any complicated waveform that repeats itself 110 times per second could be generated by using the right recipe, putting in just the right amount of each of the ingredients, the ingredients being the harmonics of 110 hertz, 220, 330, 440, and so on. To show how it goes, I've illustrated this for a kind of an unnatural, not a very musical tone, sort of a sawtooth-like tone that could be built up from a pure tone at a frequency F, one that at twice the frequency, one at three times the frequency, one at four times, five times, and six times. And if you added them up in the amounts that I've shown here, you'd get a complex tone like that. So one of the ways, certainly the common ways that you analyze musical tones, tones of musical instruments, is by doing a spectral analysis, using an electronic instrument usually. Helmholtz did it with little tuned resonators, but that's the hard way. Use an electronic instrument that tells you how much of each of these harmonics is present in the steady tone. But that, remember, is maybe it's about time to look at the matrix again. That, you remember, or will remind you, if I can find the slide back again, is only one of the things that determines timbre. Spectrum is certainly a very important determinant of timbre, but it's only one of the things. The sound pressure, the duration, the envelope, and so on, also determinant. I have a favorite demonstration. It's a recorded demonstration. I'm sorry I don't have it here to play for you. And that is a recording of a piano that's played backwards. Oh, actually, you can do it if you have a tape recorder that will play backwards, and I checked, we don't have any that will do that. But if you record the sound of a piano playing a melody, and then ask in order to make it the demonstration really good, you ought to ask the piano to play it backwards from the end to the beginning. And then you reverse the tape, so you hear the melody played forward, but with a very interesting change. it comes out sounding like a harmonium or a reed organ. Because of the fact that the transient now, that plucked sound, instead of being at the onset of the tone, is at the end of the tone. And that changes the character of the sound completely. See, the piano sound comes on slowly and decays fast. And that's completely different than a sound with exactly the same spectrum that comes on rapidly and decays slowly. So that illustrates the dependence of timbre on envelope. And if any of you have ever seen or used even perhaps an electronic music synthesizer, you know that there are attack and decay generators. If you want to create musical sounds electronically, you set the frequency, you set the loudness, you set the attack rate, you set the decay rate, you set the character of the attack and envelope. You individually set up all these parameters, because you're not going to get a desired sound unless you specify and set up all these various parameters that determine timbre. Okay. Another subject that's quite interesting, and we don't have an awful lot of time left. I suppose we have to give them a few minutes to set up, right? Vespers. Is combination tones. So far we've talked really only about the perception of single tones. Well, most music is polyphonic, or has a number of different tones that are sound at the same time. And then you get into, you open up a whole Pandora's box of, as it were, of acoustics. Because not only do you perceive these individual tones in ways that we've outlined, but you hear combinations between these sounds. One of the simplest illustrations of a combination tone, and I'm sure you've all heard examples of it, are beats that sound when you have two tones that are very close to one another in frequency. If you were to take two flutes and pull out the head joint on one so it played a little bit flat, and then play them together, you'd hear a fluctuation, a periodic fluctuation in time. Beats. Piano tuners, violinists use beats to tune their instruments. All right, if you have two tones with frequencies F1 and F2, then when you sound them together, you're going to hear a kind of an average tone between them, if they're close in frequency, if they're within 10 or 15 hertz of one another. You're going to hear a steady tone at an average frequency. F1 plus F2, one half of F1 plus F2, I guess you can almost read it. But then you're going to hear a fluctuation that occurs at the difference frequency, that occurs at F1 minus F2. Let's talk numbers. Supposing you have tones of 100 hertz and 105 hertz, then you're going to hear an average pitch that would correspond to about 102.5 hertz. But the sound is going to get louder and softer 5 times per second, because F1 minus F2, the difference in the frequencies of these two is 5 hertz. These are beats. Those, I think, are quite familiar to you. All right, now, if we used instead of musical instruments, if we used a couple of oscillators, electronic oscillators, because that makes the frequency so easy to change, and I mistuned. Supposing I kept the frequency of one of these oscillators fixed, we'll call that F1, and I slowly varied the frequency of F2. It started out the same as F1 and then gradually increased. All right, the first thing I'd hear is beats, and the beats would increase in frequency as F2 minus F1 got larger. When I got up to a beat rate of about 15 hertz, and here again it depends, these are all average figures, it depends upon the ear. Some people can hear beats faster than that, some people cannot hear them that fast. But at about 15 beats per second, the idea of beats would kind of disappear. And we'd start to hear kind of a roughness developing in that tone. And then we'll reach the next milestone, which is sometimes called the fusion frequency, And that, depending upon where you are on the musical keyboard, it could be anywhere from 20 to 100 hertz. At that point, the one tone will fall apart, and you'll start to realize that there are two tones. You see, when the difference is less than the fusion frequency, why the you get the feeling of one tone with a variable amplitude or with roughness. Well, then you start to hear two tones, but they still interact and give you a dissonance, give you a sense of roughness, until you get out to about the critical band. When the two tones are about one critical bandwidth apart, which remember musically was a little more than a whole tone apart, then they start to actually blend. And the feeling of roughness starts to disappear, and you get a musical interval of some sort or another. But again, you see the significance of the critical bandwidth. When they're close enough so that they're interacting, they're exciting the same hair cells along the basilar membrane, you get a high degree of roughness. Well, now let's take this whole curve of combination tones and let's squeeze this all together so that we can go on out in space. So the part that's represented by this middle graph now is all compressed down into the left-hand end. And when we do that, we continue separating F1 and F2 farther and farther apart. We start to get difference tones. And these difference tones, the fundamental difference tone, the F2 minus F1, is this purple line. And that's often referred to by musicians as a Tartini tone, because Tartini, the violinist in, the 16th century or something like that, or 17th century, wrote quite a bit about them. And these tones you can hear. If you have, in my book, I've got a couple little melodies that two flutes can play together in such a way that you hear a difference tone melody, a bass melody down below. A number of composers have made use of difference tones like that. Organists sometimes do it too. If you want a very low bass tone and you don't have very low bass pipes, you create difference tones by selecting combinations of stops. But in addition to this simple difference tone, which is F2 minus F1, you'll also, if you listen very carefully, you'll hear other difference tones. Now, this one is sometimes called the quadratic difference tone. What it actually is twice the frequency of the upper one minus the, I'm sorry, twice the frequency of the lower one minus the upper one. So as the two go farther and farther apart, it goes down in frequency. And then this is a quartic difference tone, which is F2 minus F1, I think it is. And there's a whole family of these difference tones that you can hear under rather special conditions.